What's up, everybody? My name is Dimitri Kafinas, and you're listening to Hidden Forces, a podcast that inspires investors, entrepreneurs, and everyday citizens to challenge consensus narratives and to learn how to think critically about the systems of power shaping our world. My guest in this week's episode is Jim Grant. Jim is the founder of Grant's Interest Rate Observer and a legend in the business of investor education and financial media. This is my third on-air conversation with Jim since starting the podcast back in 2017, and the sixth or seventh time that I've interviewed him in one capacity or another for this show or my old TV program. What I value most, though, about my relationship with Jim and about being able to talk to him from time to time is the historical perspective that he brings, not just from the immense volume of books and periodicals that he's consumed over his lifetime, but primarily from the wisdom of his own lived experiences and from the lessons he's learned from the experiences of others that he's had the privilege to know and interview over the course of his own lifetime. And from time to time, I've had the opportunity, the privilege, of being able to share one of our conversations with all of you. What prompted this one is all the recent controversy around the inflation story. Is it transitory? Is it supply-driven or demand-driven? Are the changes structural? Are they cyclical? And I couldn't think of anyone better to talk to about it for the reasons that I just described than Jim. The man has been on this story, writing about it and warning his readers about it and the consequences of dollar debasement for as long as I've known him. So what I came to this conversation wanting to know from Jim, as someone who has lived through at least three major credit cycles, is if in fact he feels that this inflation is not transitory, that if in fact we are in the active process of up-anchoring inflation expectations and what that means for the Fed and its policy options, interest rates, and most importantly, the valuation of assets like stocks and bonds, whose prices have depended on the free flow of credit that becomes much more difficult to readily source in an environment of rising consumer and producer prices. It's a phenomenal conversation that helped me more than anything else integrate the history of inflation and what we know about its causes into the unique circumstances of our modern political economy, characterized as it is by historically high debt levels, aging demographics, and technology-driven deflation in a way that makes me, and hopefully all of you, much better investors. As usual, the second part of today's conversation is available to subscribers only, and in it, Jim and I continue to explore the subject of our conversation from the first hour, but also discuss things like meme stocks, cryptocurrencies, and precious metals, which I know many of you will want Jim's perspective on, and he does not disappoint. So if you enjoyed today's episode and have not yet become a premium subscriber, there is never going to be a better time or good excuse to do so than today's episode. There's no commitment, you can cancel at any time, and the entire library of Hidden Forces subscriber content going all the way back to episode one becomes instantly available to you, including the overtimes, transcripts, and rundowns to this episode and every other episode we've ever done. Lastly, because this conversation deals with investing, I want to make absolutely clear that nothing you hear in today's conversation can or should be viewed as financial advice. All opinions expressed by me and my guest are solely our own opinions and should not be relied upon as the basis for financial decisions. So without any further ado, please enjoy this week's episode with my friend, Jim Grant. Jim Grant, welcome to Hidden Forces. I feel awkward saying that, though, because I feel like you should be welcoming me.
Well, yeah, here we are at 233 Broadway, the 24th floor. This is the headquarters of Grant's Interest Rate Observer. But you are welcome here anytime, Dimitri.
Right. So I appreciate that. You know, the first time that I met you in person was actually at Two Wall, your old address. And it was in 2012. We came to interview you for Capital Account. I think it was like April 2012. So this is like my first time in your new office, super swanky, amazing view. I actually took a picture of it.
Yeah. Well,
posted to my Instagram.
But the story, Dimitri, is not the office, but the lease.
Was it really a good deal?
No.
Oh.
No, it was a complete inappropriate stretch. I signed a 10-year lease at the age of 73. Now, what kind of crazy bullish optimism as that, I must be drinking the same water these meme stock guys are.
We're going to talk about the meme stock guys. Why did you decide to
move? I don't know. Well, we had to leave Two Wall, not because we were not current on rent, I hasten to say, but the building was being refashioned and our office was going to be lost in some new architectural plan, so we had to leave. So where to go? So we looked around. I've worked in Lower Manhattan pretty much all my working life. So I want to stay downtown. And I thought, why not go back to where I began, which is the Woolworth Building, which is right where we are sitting. So this is where I signed my first lease, not at the age of 73.
How old were you when you signed your first lease? And was it for grants when you started your business?
Yeah, I must have been late 30s. I've been doing this for about 40 years, not quite 40.
What was that, 1983?
Correct. Yeah, I was 37.
Wow. So what did it feel like to come back to the building that you started at?
Oh, you know, this line, you can't go home again. People say, yeah. Well, it happens to be true. Everything's changed. I mean, the people have gotten older and stuff.
People have gotten older.
The building head of security is now the head of the entire building. So that's good. Anyway, it is, in fact, good to be back, despite
the changes.
Yeah, despite the changes.
And there have been so many. I actually wonder about that because I'm at an age now where for the first time I have felt many times now that the world feels very different, in some ways unrecognizable from what it was when I was growing up. You know, like, and that would have been the 1990s. The 1990s was kind of like...
See, the 1990s.
The 1990s.
Yeah, well...
I mean, I was born in 1981, but... And I remember the 1980s to an extent, but it was really the 90s that I remember more sort of authoritatively. And I look back now and I'm like, that feels like it was a dream. What does that feel like for you? You were born in the 1946, I think, right?
Yeah.
Although sometimes you would say, you've joked that you were born in the 1800s. But no, you were actually born in 1946. So I'm curious, let's actually go all the way back there. Where did you grow up? I'm not actually familiar with your life story.
Well, you know, many people share that same deficit of information. It's only because they don't care one bit, but you were kind to ask. Yeah, I was born in Manhattan, and my father was just back from World War II. My mother and he got a house on Long Island, or as we say, Long Island.
Long Island.
Say it again?
Long Island.
Yeah. Yeah, so Williston Park, which is right smack dab in the middle of Nassau County. I grew up in the middle of Nassau County and wanted to leave almost instantly. Perfectly flat, you know, houses kind of cookie cutter-ish.
I know exactly where that is, actually. It's like East Williston area?
Yeah. Well, East Williston is the Tony part of the Williston's. A very pretty place. East Williston was right at a Long Island Railroad stop.
And, sure.
And it had a lovely station, which was torn down, as so many good things are. But it was a happy childhood, although I must admit that I stunk up the joint in Little League.
You were no good?
Yeah, that's right.
What position did you play?
First base.
You were a first baseman?
Light hitting first baseman, which would seem to be a contradiction in terms, but that's what they got. But I grew up loving baseball, loving music. I played the French horn at length, quite seriously, you know, practicing 2 and 3 hours a day and with hopes not unreasonable of a career in music, and went to public schools. My father was a Juilliard-trained timpanist. My mother was artistic in her own way. Yeah, it was a sweet time.
So interesting, because Alan Greenspan also was a jazz musician and a very good one at that.
No, he was a journeyman.
What is the difference?
Journeyman is a ham and eggs, as in boxing, the term is ham and eggs. Ordinary.
I'm not familiar with that.
Dimitri, you have to learn
have
these
to
cultural touch
this.
Points. You know, mediocre.
Ah.
Mediocre. And he was the first to admit that. To my brother, my twin brother, who happened to sit next to one evening, utterly random event, some social event in Washington, he sat next to Alan Greenspan, and they got to talking, my brother asked Alan Greenspan about his career in jazz, and Greenspan said, I never practiced. That is the giveaway.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
I remember when you interrogated him on the stage. You had him once.
Yeah. That was kind of a non-meeting of the minds, I must say.
Hmm.
Alan Greenspan was a close business acquaintance of my mentor at Barron's, where I worked for a number of years. My mentor's name was Bob Blyberg. And Bob Blyberg and Alan Greenspan were both in the day acolytes of Ayn Rand, the famous objectivist novelist. You know, Alan Greenspan, under her influence, and indeed under his own conviction, wrote a very strong affirmation of the imperative of the gold standard, not the desirability, but the imperative of the gold standard. This was, he was a kid, like you, 40, but not a kid.
Wasn't it like 1966 or something?
Yeah, correct.
Yeah.
But I said kid facetiously, not a grown-up man. He wrote this, and then he went on to go to the Fed, and he—
The Great Debaser.
Yeah. He insisted in my company and in the company of many others that he ran the Fed as one would run a central bank on the gold standard.
Mm.
No. No, he did not.
Mm.
He ran it quite imaginatively on the paper improv standard.
The faith-based monetary system.
Yeah, the PhD standard.
PhD standard, as you famously call it. I remember when I had Sebastian Mallaby on the podcast, and he had written a book at the time. That's why he had come on, titled The Man Who Knew, about Alan Greenspan. It was the biography of Alan Greenspan. And he had spent many hours interviewing him. And one of the things—
A peculiar way to spend your time, by the way.
It is. It's, well, you know, Sebastian's a curious guy. Definitely a geek, a history geek. And I remember he said that Greenspan told him that the way that he reconciled his position in the 60s with his position as Fed chair was that he felt that the gold standard ultimately was unnecessary because the decision to go off the standard in 1971 proved that point by virtue of the fact that it's up to policymakers whether or not they want to adhere to it. And if they adhere to it, then they don't need it. Because what's the point of having gold if you run a tight monetary policy?
I would say that's a little sophistical. The point is well taken. The policymakers did everything they could to cheat on it, to work around it. The 1960s were one long workaround. So the United States was losing bullion. Let me back up one step. So the Bretton Woods monetary system, which dates from 1944 or functionally 1946, had this key component that the official overseas holders of dollars, governments or central banks, could, at their own choosing, demand to exchange those dollar bills for gold at the fixed rate of $35 an ounce. It was kind of at the heart of Bretton Woods, as that system, as I say, was known. So the United States was losing gold to its overseas creditors starting in the late 50s. And the outflow continued in the 60s. And at that rate, anyone could see that either the United States would have had to raise its rate of interest, thereby making dollars more attractive to hold, or do other things to bring its economy into conformity with the characteristics that marked a well-functioning orthodox economy in gold standard days. But it did not choose to do that. Rather, it chose to do such things as to implement a gold pool, which attempted to fix the price of gold and tamp it down. The price of gold was creeping up because people had seen that the U.S. might go off the gold standard. So there was the London Gold Pool. There was something called Operation Twist. So we don't need to get into details. But one by one, these gimmicks were attempted, and none exactly did the job. And at length, 1971, Nixon finally cut the cord. And the United States no longer stood ready to exchange its dollar bills for gold at $35 an ounce. So that was a great moment in our monetary affairs, a terrifically significant event. And from that day to this, 50 years, you're going to be 40.
Mm-hmm.
And the post-Bretton Woods regime was 50 this past summer. Mm. By the way, have you had your birthday yet, Dimitri? Happy birthday.
I have. Thank you. Oh, I have. Yeah, I have.
So we have had one half a century to become accustomed to this most unusual state of monetary affairs, unusual in the long history of money.
Yeah.
The idea that that a government could conjure a money on a printing press or tap it into existence on a computer keypad is a relatively new idea. And the idea that could keep it going for half a century is a very new thing. But here we are.
In some ways, things haven't changed too much. You know, central banks are still in the business of trying to set expectations and defend their credibility through all sorts of different ways. And I wonder how you think they've been doing on that front.
Well, in one sense, they have been succeeding beyond one's imagination. You consider the institution of the Fed as a bank, right? That's its genus and species. It is a central bank. And it failed in its duties in 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007, or indeed 2002, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. It did not see coming what some of us did see coming, which was the great financial crisis precipitated by a systematic and systemic failure in the art of lending and borrowing. And so mortgages became a great big joke. Anyone could get one, two, or three, or four with as many houses. And Wall Street was borrowing freely and not wisely, and everyone was encumbering his or her business or cash flows. Governments were in debt. So this resulted in the great financial crisis. So the Fed, having seen none of this, never confessed to error, but came out of it with a great deal more power than what it had going into it, which leads me to wonder, and indeed to assert, that you're never in your life going to own a stock of a company that is that bulletproof. You can only dream about having one that could fail and fail upwards and get more of prestige, more power. So in that sense, the Fed has been a great institutional success. You know, when Judy Shelton, Trump's nominee for a spot on the Federal Reserve Board, came within 100 yards of the place, the powers that be mobilized to impugn her judgment and her bona fides and her ideas, just to keep this crazy woman out of the building, right? Somebody who believed in fixed exchange rates, somebody who believed in a convertible currency. Judy's not a dogmatist on the gold standard, but and she kind of plays a little bit coy sometimes, but she's basically a gold standard person. And the idea within the Fed of having such a heretic on the premises was just so appalling that the circumstantial evidence, which I find persuasive, that the Jay Powell himself personally lobbied senators to assure that her nomination would get nowhere. So as a political animal, this central bank is a great success. I think as a as a manager of the nation's monetary affairs, I think it's not been a success.
Yeah, and to the point about credibility, it seems, you know, the Volcker administration did a lot to bolster the Fed's credibility. And it's kind of been downward sloping ever since maybe either the early 2000s or certainly after 2008.
Yeah, you know, the Volcker moment was a very painful one for many people who lost farms, businesses, lost jobs, their hopes for the future because of these treetop interest rates. And the
like the period between 79 and 81,
yeah,
roughly?
Yeah. Volcker came in and the rate of interest on long-dated 30-year U.S. Treasury at 9%. At the peak, it was 15%. Mortgages were like 20%. You know, it's a, can't conceive of it now. So yes, Volcker earned for his personal courage and perseverance, he earned a great deal of respect, and I certainly respected him. He was up against this wall of loathing from people who had been displaced by his policies. And of course, he made no great friends on Capitol Hill by sticking to his guns. He made some, I think, but on the whole, I think political America wished that he would ease up a little bit and let people breathe. But he was all for breaking the back of inflation, which indeed he succeeded in doing, but at great cost again. You know, he was a Treasury official before he became the Fed chairman. And it was in that capacity under the administration of, I guess, Lyndon Johnson, 1966, perhaps, maybe mid-60s, certainly. He led a team of three people. He was asked to appraise the outlook for prices. And they said it was a short-dated horizon they were asked to forecast. And they thought this would be fine, no inflation. So Paul Volcker was not a visionary on inflation problem in the 70s, got a running start in the 60s. We tend to forget this. In 1967, towards the end of 1967, William McChesney Martin, who was then the Fed chairman and a great rhetorical enemy of inflation, gave speeches throughout the 50s and the early 60s about how we should suffer no inflation. He was an absolutist on the matter. But, you know, the inflation rate got going in the mid-60s, and before you know it, it was like 4 or 5%. And
when did it get to 4 or 5%?
Mid-60s. 65 mid-60s. was the inflation point. So in late 67, William McChesney Martin throws in the towel. He says to the Federal Reserve Board, he says, the horse of inflation is out of the barn. That's a direct quote. And the approximate quote paraphrase is, the best we can hope is to run this animal down, make sure it doesn't get too far away.
Hmm. How did they do that? What was the response of the Fed at the time? Like, what tools did they have?
Well, they could have raised the federal funds rate, their rate of policy rate of interest. They could have raised the discount rate, another rate they controlled. But Martin had made a deal with Lyndon Johnson, then president, that if Johnson would take care of the fiscal deficit, that he, Martin, would go slow on raising interest rates. There were, of course, elections looming. 1968 was one. It was a kind of a pact with the devil on both sides. But there was, something is obvious, but is rarely admitted or spoken of, is that for all we think we know what causes a serious bout of inflation, we really don't know.
Mm.
And the Fed's been trying to juice one for years. You kind of think you know. For example, there's a story I like to tell about the old St. Louis Cardinals teams in the late 60s with Bob Gibson, the Hall of Fame pitcher. And there was a light-hitting infielder named Ducky Schofield. Mm. Ducky was a 230 lifetime hitter. Good glove, light stick. And one day, Ducky was at bat, and he struck out. And he stalked back to the dugout, slammed his bat down, chucked his batting helmet against the backside of the dugout, broke the water cooler, cussed up a blue streak. Gibson couldn't stand it, and he summoned Ducky over to his regal presence. Get over here, Schofield. And Gibson pointed to Schofield's batting average, and he said to him, what did you expect?
That's so funny.
So a little bit, that's the way I've been thinking about inflation when the Fed is buying $120 billion a month of securities with money that didn't exist before it conjured it into being. And the Trump administration, the Biden has been running these humongous deficits. And then the Biden administration doing everything in its power to discourage the production of fossil fuels, the prices of which, as one might have noticed, have been going up, the gas pump. And so you kind of think that maybe people were asking for inflation and they got it. But with all of that said and conceded, still, it is rather a mystery how it comes. You know, the inflation of the 60s, again, to mark 60s and 70s, was the first peacetime inflation of any consequence in American history.
Mm.
First peacetime consequence. No, there's Vietnam War, but that was not the thing. It came from somewhere, and we can think we know, but we can't be certain. And now we got one, and people are dogmatizing about it. Yeah, we got one, or it's transitory. No, we don't have one.
Mm-hmm.
It's not too much to say, Dimitri, that nobody knows nothing.
Why? That's a question I wanted to ask you. Nobody knows nothing. Why is it that it's so difficult to find any type of consensus around not just whether or not it's transitory, but what is even driving it, if it is?
Correct. One is led almost to believe that economics is an art.
Mm. Not a
or,
science.
Or an opinion or something. And, you know, it seems like every other economist you hear about has won the Nobel Prize. That's my impression, at least. You read somebody's name in the paper, so-and-so, economist, so-and-so, comma, Nobel laureate. Yeah, they all are. Right, people have been getting Nobel laureates since Friedrich Hayek had the first one, I guess, in the early 70s. But there's a lot of time for a lot of Nobel laureates. And they all have different opinions and different approaches to analysis. And you don't find some physicist disagreeing with the other one about whether gravity works. You know, it's a different line of work, economics.
Right.
It's dealing with human behavior. And
do you think, I've listened to a number of different people whose opinions I value to one degree or another for all sorts of reasons. And I was struck by the fact that, let's take two examples. I could pick a number out of a hat, but let's take someone like Lawrence Summers, who has prominently come out in support of the view that this is not transitory,
right,
that inflation is serious and that the Fed is in danger of falling behind the curve. And we can talk about what that means to fall behind the curve, because I'm also somewhat confused about what the operative mechanism is.
And what the curve is.
And what the curve is. But and that's a way of asking about to what degree or expectations what really drives inflation or what policymakers are concerned about. And compare his view to someone like Neil Kashkari, for example, who's substantially younger. Well, I don't know exactly how old Kashkari is. I don't know what his experience of the 1970s was, but perhaps he lacks the experience, maybe not of the 70s, of growing up in the 70s. Maybe he was a kid in the 70s and remembers it, but maybe he doesn't remember that transition of actually having one view of the world in the early 1960s and then a completely different one in the 1970s. How much do you think the differences in opinion come from life experience in this matter?
Yeah, I think some. I think it's a poor reflection on the discipline, if that's the word, of economics, that one had to have lived through it in order to form an analytical view of it.
Very, very good point.
But I think that with that said, I think that it does make a big difference. I mean, if you live through those years and there were 15 of them, at a minimum, it's inflation got started in 1965, I say. That was when it kind of peaked above 3%. And it was still roaring in 1980. It was like 12% in CPI. Well, oh, that's not so hard to imagine now, right? And it moderated, but it was certainly 15 years and then some. And that's a formative part of any human's life. And so you live
there
a
were
bit,
some years that were really bad.
Yeah. I mean,
difficult to comprehend.
Correct. And so you live a little longer and then things change. All things are cyclical, of course. And then in the same lifetime, mine, a great good fortune, one lives to see a time in which some interest rates are below zero. Such is the conviction of people that inflation will never come back, that sentient human beings buy fixed income securities priced to yield less than nothing in the same lifetime. Mm. Having seen bonds, some utility company bonds fetch 20%, you know, not junk either. This is extraordinary. So if you live long enough on Wall Street, you see everything. And if you're lucky enough, you see it two or three times. And then, Dimitri, you might get the hang of it.
I wonder. That's actually something I wonder about.
Oh, here's something. So a friend of mine quotes this wizened old guy. I always quote a wizened old guy from the youth. Yeah, this guy must have been 80 years old. And he said, kid, I'm quoting my friend, quoting this guy. In every Wall Street career, you live to see the Dow Jones Industrial Average at book value twice.
Interesting.
I'm not sure what book value in the Dow is, but I assure you, Dimitri, it's a lot lower.
Yeah. So here's a question for you. Actually, speaking of book values, what year was it that equities peaked in the 1960s? Was it 66? Am I remembering correctly?
66 was a peak in the Dow, but the speculative froth continued into the late 60s, and then the market got narrower and narrower, and then the famous Nifty 50 took off. The 50 select growth stocks had their moment, and everything rolled over in 1973. And the great bear market bottom, a truly important, I think the Dow Jones Industrial Average might have traded at book value in 1974. The fall of 1974 was the bottom. But there's kind of a rolling top market getting narrower. 66 is one way of looking at it. The Dow was 1,000 in 1960, this is from memory, but the Dow was 1,000 in 1966, and then again 1,000 in 1982 or so. So it was—
Right, because the inflation, real values were significantly reduced.
Sure, and the nominal value—
traded sideways for the decade. No?
Trod water.
Yeah.
Is that the past tense of treaded water?
I don't know, that's a good question.
No, it's not.
You should know, you're the wordsmith.
Yeah, but—
So I think one of the things that is noteworthy that I notice is that, and so much happens these days on social media, you know, these conversations.
So I'm told.
Yeah. Well, you have an account. You have a Twitter account. Yeah, are you ever on there or anything? Do you have any?
No. You know, why should I squander my stuff on Twitter for free? I can't understand why people do it.
Well, I don't know if you watched Dave Chappelle, but he had a great stand-up comedy show recently on Netflix. And towards the end of it, he said something along the lines of something like, I don't know. I don't care what they said on Twitter because Twitter's not a real place. But anyways, it's a good point.
Like it's not Brooklyn, right?
No, it's not Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And so on Twitter, I noticed that the thing with inflation in the way that people refer to it is that since the financial crisis, there were a lot of people who were claiming or saying that we're going to get massive inflation or hyperinflation. And I think what they meant at the time was inflation and consumer prices, right, and producer prices. But that no one ever really adjusted their definition. And they just kind of rolled that into the asset price inflation that we saw. And now it seems that people are similarly rolling it back into consumer and producer prices like they're interchangeable. But the thing is, they aren't necessarily. So like the rise in inflation in the way that we traditionally think of it in consumer and producer prices is not actually good for the stock market historically, correct?
In consumer and Main Street inflation. No.
Correct.
Insofar as it causes the rate of interest to rise, it is bad for growth stocks.
Right, exactly. And you have to differentiate between what types of businesses.
Right. Some businesses with immediate, observable, and monetizable cash flows do well. If you have pricing power, you can do well. A lot of stocks did well in the 60s and 70s. But what our zero interest rate environment has done is to empower imaginations. You can, without having to pay a lot to borrow money, in fact, you can borrow money for very little, you can project future cash flows on growth stocks who haven't begun to generate even revenues, let alone profits. But when the rate of interest begins to bite and it costs money to borrow, imaginations get a very short leash.
Well, so to that point, you mentioned the Nifty 50s. And while those were the kind of growth stocks of the day, the extent to which they relied on credit markets to fuel that growth was, I mean, how do you compare that to what we have today, to the extent to which credit is an important part of what drives the stock market? And the reason I bring that up again is because it speaks again to what are the consequences of inflation in today's era versus what were the consequences in the 60s? And then the next sort of question obviously there is, well, how should investors think about that relative to how they thought about it then?
Well, it's a big difference. And the big difference has to do with the amount of debt in the economy and the uses to which this debt is put. Private equity, we should call them leverage buyouts before leverage buyouts got a bad name after the first explosion in early 90s. Private equity is the business of buying a public company and taking it private, borrowing a lot of money against the projected future prosperity of this company, paying yourself a big dividend as you, the private owner, and then in the fullness of time, taking it public again. And this has been become an immense business. It's everyone's favorite asset class in the endowment world. You know, everyone wants to be like the Yale endowment and have a big private equity exposure. So this speaks to your question about credit or debt, which is a less respectable name than credit, but same thing. So private equity, as the stock market has risen, has been paying more and more for companies, higher price for a dollar of earnings of those companies, and it has been borrowing more money against those companies. So what this does is to diminish the margin of safety in the transaction. You have less room for things to go wrong. What you want is a margin of safety so you can prosper in adversity as you can in a boom. That's the old-time view. But one of the big differences today is that the Fed is ever on the spot to medicate, to soothe, and to forestall difficulty. To medicate and soothe if it happens, to forestall lest it happen. But people have come to view business cycles as the home builders in South Florida did, hurricanes before Hurricane Andrew struck. I've forgotten the year. It was a devastating hurricane.
95, was it? Or was that Hugo?
I don't know.
I think it was 95.
Hurricane Andrew was so devastating because the builders had gotten so out of practice at bad hurricanes, they began to kind of skirt the building code a little bit, and nobody seemed to mind because bad hurricanes were from yesteryear. And
so it's amazing how that works.
Yeah. So in building codes, as in finance, so a lot more leverage in private equity, a lot more leverage in the stock market itself, a lot more leverage in government finance, a lot more leverage, everything. So a lot more debt. So high prices, low interest rates, lots of debt. So in the 1960s and 70s, there was much less debt, What debt does is to instill fragility. And say, Hyman Minsky, he's an economist who is worth quoting and reading. Minsky proposed that the leveraged capital structure, he observed it, I suppose, because it's self-evident once you see it and think about it, that the more debt you put on a set of cash flows, the greater the risk that if those cash flows disappoint, that you could wind up broke, right? Because if mm-hmm. you can't service your debt, you go to court and turn over your business to the creditors. So that introduces the risk of systemic bankruptcy, introduces the risk of bank failure. So that to me is that 15 minutes ago you asked this question, the difference between the inflation then and the much shorter experience with inflation now is that debt is much larger and
structural in a way. Do you think there's a,
yes,
there's an expectation of—
Absolutely. Hmm. The inflation is an expectation that we must be leveraged because you earn more as an equity holder if you can apply more debt to your thing.
Mm-hmm. And of course, that speaks directly to the diminishment of yields over the course of several decades.
Right. So yields have been falling since 1981. People have become, that's a lot of muscle memory, right? 40 years of falling interest rates, people, they won't rise. You know the last time they were up? 40 years ago. But notice that a lot of debt, or say on Wall Street, a lot of leverage, increases the risk presented by rising interest rates, of course, because you suddenly have to pay more on that debt that you were able to lay off at a very favorable, very low rate of interest. So rising inflation / rising interest rates, if the two were synonymous, that's the kryptonite of a great boom. Mm. Right? What you least want is rising interest rates if you have an economy honeycombed with debt. That's what you least want.
Right. And I would add on top of that, exactly what you said, plus inflation, because that turns it into a wicked problem.
Yeah, right, right. But notice that interest rates have really not risen. Now, it might be, we can cast around for reasons for that, say the central banks still have them under their thumb, but they don't have all the rates under their thumb. I can imagine that if the market got it into its head that inflation were not transitory, as Jay Powell was wont to say, but as the young folks say, if inflation were a thing, right, that you would not want to hold a long bond, a long-dated bond denominated in dollars, because the purchasing power of those dollars would diminish. Already, you have lost 6% plus over the past year of purchasing power. And by the way, you never get that back. That's the feature of this paper money regime that people don't talk about. But in the olden days, there would be cycles of inflation and an alternating cycle of deflation, prices would fall. And over the course of 100 years or so, prices would end where they began. And that actually happened in the heart of the gold standard 19th century and into the early 20th. But now it's like a ratchet that only doesn't ratchet backwards.
Is that because we're like on a permanently managed economy?
Yeah, I think we live in an age of inflation. So William McChesney Martin, the aforequoted Fed chairman, from his dates were 1951 to 1970. And Martin was wont to say, you never get the purchasing power back again. Mm. So you're just out. You're just out 6.5% of everything you thought you'd saved. Gone.
So we're jumping a little ahead here. Actually, we're jumping quite a bit ahead, because I had in my rundown here, I wanted to ask you also about your career, how you started grants, and a number of other things related to the supply-driven, demand-driven dynamics here. But let's skip ahead and let me ask you this, which is, where do you think we go from here, Jim? Because to your point, this isn't a situation where we've been readily cycling through cycles of inflation and deflation. It's been one long inflation for quite a long time. And markets have embedded certain expectations around the Fed and its response function and its support of equity markets, which themselves have become the primary savings vehicle of Americans. So they've gone from being, they're a political liability, so to speak, the markets for the federal government.
Right, correct.
So how does this resolve itself? Is there any going back? If not, obviously, we never step in the same river twice, but can we use this as an opportunity to transition back into a world where investors can't expect the Federal Reserve to bail them out, that markets just only go up and nothing ever goes down?
Events have their say. You know, the enemy has an opinion and idea too in a battle. So So events have their sway, and arithmetic has its own potent power. And there comes a time that markets get so high that they run out of buyers, so high that the narratives become self-evidently nonsensical, so high that no amount of hype and no number of press releases can sustain the conviction that next year's earnings too are going to be up 40%. You know? So there's an end to all these booms. Booms go boom. And the modern expression of this is that so many people say, bull markets don't die of old age. They die because the Fed raises rates or something. Well, I don't know. Many of us have come to believe that the Fed is in charge of things, right? The Fed won't let this market get away. Way back when, people would say they won't let this market get away from them. This is before the Fed was even, there was always a they. It used to be, you know.
Used to be JP Morgan.
Yeah, right. Morgan or.
The banking trust.
Or, yeah, right. Right, the money trust. So where does it end? So here are some possibilities. One is that inflation proves nettlesome and then some, and the Fed is put in the position of having to do something about it, something that we used to call tightening, not just loosening less, but actually raising its rate of interest, its negligible, inconsequential 0% rate of interest, and actually selling something from its immense portfolio now rising above $8.5 trillion.
Incredible.
Yeah. And I wonder whether the people running the Fed now have the fortitude to do such a thing. I mean, to suffer the pain of a falling stock market, the Fed can't stand the sight of blood.
Well, there's also a lot of political pressure
on the
Fed.
Of course,
by the Biden administration.
Always have been.
Always has been. But in particular now, there's the argument of Trump and what happens in 2024. So this is like another dynamic laid on top of this.
Well, there's the dynamic too of Jay Powell not wanting to lose a job. Why anyone would want this job now is beyond me, but our president now is contemplating this. He's seriously, seriously considering it. And he's going to have an answer by Thanksgiving, or is it Thanksgiving of next year, or Christmas, or perhaps Arbor Day, or something.
I think Evan Lorenz, your deputy editor, made a joke about pardoning Powell on the same day that he pardons the turkey.
Right. Yeah, that's Evan. Anyway, I'm dancing around your question, where is it? And I think that something is going to call time on the Fed. And that might be the frail structure of our financial architecture, honeycombed as it is with debt. It might be a stock market crash precipitated perhaps by arithmetic, or maybe someone in China decides to covet Taiwan and to do so with force or whatever. You can imagine all sorts of things. One can't be dogmatic having lived through the past 18 months, right? How certain can you be about the future, about tomorrow, seeing what we have seen in the past 18 months?
And yet none of those macro events seem to really imperil markets. You could argue that the pandemic did, but the Fed proved capable in arresting the decline.
Right, except the Fed now is confronting a rate of inflation it never dreamt was even possible. And now it's proven not transitory. So the Fed might be a little bit less keen to run to the defense of the market by opening up the spigots again. We don't know, but I think it's going to be great copy for Grant's Interest Rate Observer, Dimitri.
I'm sure it will be. Well, that I totally agree with you. And actually, you said something else there, which is many people keep thinking about this in terms of, well, what if the Fed tightens? How much can it tighten before markets take a hit? Can they balance this act? But what you hinted to there is a possibility that other people haven't really considered, which is that markets just simply take a dump for whatever reason, maybe in anticipation of a rate hike, and the Fed doesn't have the room to actually intervene.
Well, look at the Reserve Bank of Australia, that place far, far away. The Central Bank of Australia had set up a kind of a bright red line. It set a level of short-term interest rates that it was going to hold, and the market had a different idea. The market wanted that rate to be higher, and the central bank got out of the way and said, yeah, okay, make it higher. So we saw this throughout the 70s. The Federal Reserve became rather a laughingstock on Wall Street because it never could seem to get in front of events. Events were leading around by the nose, and I think that is something that people might have to become accustomed to again. When they say the Fed is behind the curve, what that means is the Fed is reacting rather than acting. Mm-hmm.
So this speaks to a question I want to ask you. First of all, it's not clear how much of this is supply-driven versus demand-driven. And if it's supply-driven, it isn't clear, to me at least, what raising interest rates would do to decrease inflation. However, if it's demand-driven, is the argument essentially that the operative mechanism is expectations, inflation expectations? That, in other words, inflation expectations set into action a chain of events that prevents the Federal Reserve from acting in real time to arrest the increases in prices, and then basically is constantly playing catch up. And it no longer is in a position to dictate terms, and it's basically fighting on its heels.
Yeah. Well, that view of expectations has been dominant within the Federal Reserve and in the economics profession generally, I think. It used to be Milton Friedman is the author of the famous dictum, inflation is always and everywhere. That's Milton Friedman for you. You know, didactic and certain.
Always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon.
Correct. Always and everywhere. Well, yeah, I don't know, maybe some mostly. but inflation to me is a bear market in money. It's the loss of confidence in the purchasing power of the thing that you hold for its ability to retain value, being one of the functions of money. So if you lose confidence in it, you want to get rid of dollar bills in exchange for things that will hold value. Now, one of my first stories when I was a kind of a cub reporter on the Baltimore Sun, it was in the 1970s, and I went out to see some professor maybe at the University of Baltimore, and this guy was an economics professor. He had this idea: the best investment you can make is to buy household products now before the prices went up. He said, never mind the stock market. Go out and buy some shaving cream. It's 49 cents today. That's how long ago it was. You watch, he said, you're going to be 69 cents within 3 months. And how can you do better than that in the stock market? And I think we're seeing some of that behavior now, people buying in expectation of rising prices. But this has only been going for, 10 months now or 11 months. I mean, this is, by the time that this professor, imagine at the University of Baltimore, I imagine, told me this, this was the year 10 of an inflation, or year, 8 or 10 of inflation that had been going on since mid-60s. And everything is all coming on in a rush now.
Everything's happening faster.
Yeah, don't you think?
Yeah. I think that's actually true. Not just in when it comes to markets and inflation, but everything.
Yeah.
Everything's moving faster.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, that it's funny you say that, because the third episode that I ever did on this podcast was with a philosopher. Actually, he had degrees in philosophy and theology, and I think he taught both. His name is Mark C. Taylor over at Columbia, and he had written a book called Speed Limits. And it was basically a reflection on the way in which life and everything about it had been speeding up, and that there are limits to the speed with which we can do things. And certainly investing is one of those things. You know, the faster you invest, the less time you have to actually know what you're invested in, you know?
And that so maybe the ideology or the official doctrine of the efficient market came along just in time to allow people to invest without checking.
Yeah, exactly.
By index fund. Fast.
Yeah. Yeah. So that raises something else. Jim, I'm going to move the second part of our conversation into the overtime. There's so much more that I want to get into. We'll see what we can and what we can't. I do want to explore some more this conversation about what is actually driving the inflation. Obviously, we don't know, but maybe we can speculate. I also, like I said, of course, I want to ask you about gold. I want to ask you about crypto. I want to ask you about asset price volatility, investing in this environment. Some of the sociological phenomena, like this casino culture, meme stocks. And it would be interesting to get your perspective on this, given the fact that you've seen as much of you as you have. And to that point, you mentioned the Baltimore Sun. I think it was the Baltimore Sun you worked at, right?
Correct, right.
And you said you were a Cubs reporter? Is that what?
No, I said the Baltimore Orioles was a team, but I was a Cub reporter.
You were a Cub reporter. Got it. Okay.
Means a green reporter.
Okay. You were a Cub reporter, but you were reporting on the Baltimore Orioles. I'm fascinated to understand how you got into this business and what that experience was like, because, you know, speaking personally, I'm obviously in media, but the media landscape has changed so much. And you very much launched, I don't know what we would have called it then, a newsletter, a media company, what you would have called it, but you launched it in very much the analog world. And I'm curious what sorts of challenges you faced and overcame. So that's the teaser for the overtime. For anyone who is new to the program, Hidden Forces is listener supported. We don't accept advertisers or commercial sponsors. The entire show is funded from top to bottom by listeners like you. If you want access to the second hour of today's conversation with Jim, as well as the transcripts and rundowns to this episode and every other episode we've ever done, head over to hiddenforces.io and check out our episode library or subscribe directly through our Patreon page at patreon.com/hiddenforces. There's also a link in the summary page to this episode with instructions on how to connect the overtime feed to your phone so that you can listen to these extra discussions just like you listen to the regular podcast. Jim, stick around. We're going to move the...
I'm going to do that.
You got to let me get through this. We got to get to the other side. Stick around. We're going to move it to the second hour. For more information about this week's episode, or if you want easy access to related programming, visit our website at hiddenforces.io and subscribe to our free email list. If you want access to overtime segments, episode transcripts, and show rundowns full of links and detailed information related to each and every episode, check out our premium subscription available through the Hidden Forces website or through our Patreon page at patreon.com/hiddenforces. Today's episode was produced by me and edited by Stylianos Nikolaou. For more episodes, you can check out our website at hiddenforces.io. Join the conversation at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Hidden Forces Pod, or send me an email at dk@hiddenforces.io. As always, thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.